we have the national outgoing president of the American Medical Association with us to talk about an informational presentation on the national tort reform issue. And we also have with us today John Moorhead, who is the president of the Oregon Medical Association, who will be introducing our guest speaker, Donald Palmisano. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Dr. John Moorhead. I'm president of the Oregon Medical Association and a practicing emergency physician from Portland, where I've been for 27 years. It's my honor to host Dr. Donald J. Palmisano. Dr. Palmisano is the immediate past president of the American Medical Association. Dr. Palmisano has dedicated his career to improving the health of his patients and his profession. His career in organized medicine began auspiciously when, as a member of the Louisiana State Medical Society House of Delegates, he played a key role in passage of the Louisiana Medical Malpractice Act of 1975. This legislation capped non-economic damages in medical liability cases and put Louisiana on the tort reform map. Today, medical liability reform remains a passion for Dr. Palmisano. Since his election to the AMA Board of Trustees, first in 1996 and again in 1999, he has testified to Congress and spoken to the national media about the current medical liability crisis. Among other professional organizations, Dr. Palmisano sits on the board of directors of the National Patient Safety Foundation. A graduate of Tulane University School of Medicine and Loyola University School of Law, Dr. Palmisano is a clinical professor of surgery and medical jurisprudence at Tulane and a board-certified surgeon in private practice. He was inaugurated as AMA president in June of 2003. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome, Dr. Palmisano, and I apologize for not putting the doctor in front of your titles today. I apologize for that. Here from Jefferson Parish, Louisiana. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairwoman Burdick, and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. On behalf of the physicians and medical students of the American Medical Association, thank you for holding this hearing and giving me the opportunity to talk with you today about a very serious threat to health care as we know it, the medical liability crisis. As you heard, I'm Dr. Donald Palmisano, immediate past president of the American Medical Association and the general and vascular surgeon from New Orleans, Louisiana. My testimony is on behalf of the American Medical Association, which sets policy through a democratic process in its House of Delegates composed of physicians representing every state and over 100 national medical specialty societies, federal agencies, federal service agencies, as well as medical students. Today I've been asked to provide a national perspective of the medical liability crisis. In my role at the AMA, I've had the privilege to travel around this great country and talk firsthand with patients, physicians, and legislators like yourselves about the impact this crisis has had on their lives and the lives of their constituents. Today, I bring you both good news and bad. First, the bad news. Today, 20 states, including Oregon, have reached a full-blown medical liability crisis. In these states, access to critical medical care is seriously threatened as rising medical liability costs and the fear of litigation have forced physicians to retire early, limit their practices, or move to states that are not facing a crisis. In a 2003 report by Blue Cross Blue Shield Association, 56% of the Blue Cross Blue Shield plans in crisis states report that physicians are leaving their practice, retiring, or no longer performing some high-risk procedures. I'm often asked how we define a crisis state. Put simply, a state is in crisis when patients no longer have access to critical medical care, like emergency care. Let me share with you a story about John Lucas. In 2003, 17-year-old John Lucas from Greenwood, Mississippi, was in an auto accident. John suffered a serious head injury and was taken to Delta Regional Medical Center in Greenville, which has a level 2 trauma center. Tragically, that day, Greenville's only remaining neurosurgeon was not available. John had to be airlifted to University Medical Center in Jackson, but by the time he arrived, it was too late. He never regained consciousness and died 6 weeks later. For 25 years, Greenville had 24-hour neurosurgical coverage, but the medical liability crisis in Mississippi ended then. One of the two neurosurgeons in Greenville no longer practiced neurosurgery because of the legal climate and the cost of liability insurance. John's father, himself a trauma surgeon, said his son, quote, picked the wrong day to have his accident. The bleed inside his head had doubled by the time he received care, end of quote. There's also the story of Leanne Dice from Vicksburg. Her husband, Tony, was in an auto accident and suffered a head injury that resulted in permanent brain damage because there no longer was a neurosurgeon at the hospital, as he had left the state because of the liability crisis. Here in Oregon, which was one of the first states identified by the AMA as in crisis, the crisis has not waned. In fact, it is getting worse. According to the Oregon Health and Sciences University survey of qualified professionals who deliver babies in Oregon, 125 of these professionals stopped delivering babies in the past 4 years. And in the past 18 months, more neurosurgeons left the state or retired than came into Oregon. As in many crisis states, rural areas have been hardest hit. Just 2 years ago, Roseburg Women's Healthcare, which delivered 80% of the babies in the area, was forced to shut its doors as a result of the medical liability crisis. And nearly one-third of the physicians in eastern Oregon have stated they are considering relocating their practice. What is particularly frightening to me is the lasting impact the current crisis will undoubtedly have on the future of medicine. According to a recent survey of third and fourth year medical students, almost half indicated that the liability crisis was a factor in their specialty choice, and 39% said that the medical liability situation was a factor in determining which state they would like to complete their residency. As an aside, I had the privilege today to visit with the residents at the university today. We have a wonderful group of residents there. I was happy to tell them that the American Medical Association has donated over $600,000 to the university over the last 50 years as part of our AMA Foundation. And now this money, as we give money going forward, is dedicated to the medical students and to the research at the university. So they were very happy to be aware of that, to learn of that. So what's driving this crisis? In short, escalating jury awards and settlements and the high cost of defending against lawsuits, even those without merit, are driving medical liability premiums to unprecedented levels. Since 1996, the average jury award has nearly doubled nationwide. Here in Oregon, there have been 34 verdicts of settlements of $1 million or more since 1999, when the Oregon Supreme Court overturned the cap on non-economic damages enacted by the legislature in 1987. In addition to ballooning payouts, considerable economic resources are being squandered by fruitless legal wrangling over non-meritorious claims. About 75% of all claims end with no payment to the patient. Yet it is still very expensive for a physician to defend against these claims. When a case goes to trial and the physician is found not negligent, it costs nearly $90,000, the national average, to defend the case. Here in Oregon, the average cost to defend a physician professional liability claim has risen 121% since 1999. However, even when an injured patient receives an award, the current system is extremely inefficient, with court costs and attorney's fees often consuming a substantial portion of the award. All of these factors are driving double-digit premium increases for medical liability insurance. As all of you know, insurers establish rates prospectively. Therefore, premiums set today must take into account the escalating jury awards and rising costs to defend a suit in the future. Here in Oregon, physicians have experienced repeated double-digit increases for medical liability premiums over the past few years. According to the Northwest Physicians Mutual Insurance Company, which insures over 2,000 physicians in Oregon, family practice physicians who also deliver babies paid an average of $8,550 for medical liability insurance in 1999. In 2004, they were paying $36,896. During the same period, premiums for obstetricians rose from $21,895 to over $72,000. Exacerbating the problem is a growing number of insurers like St. Paul and Farmers that have exited the market altogether. Since 1999, at least 7 insurers have exited the market in Oregon. These deteriorating market conditions and ballooning costs have left an increasing number of physicians with virtually no choice but to retire early, limit their services, or leave the state entirely. We have even seen young, talented physicians leave medicine to pursue other occupations. It's clear the current system is critically flawed. The good news is that there are proven examples of long-term reforms that have kept physicians' liability premiums stable, but more importantly, have ensured and protected patients' access to health care. The AMA strongly supports policymakers, physicians, patients, and others working together to enact reforms based on proven success. Together we can fix the broken medical liability system. As legislators, you are in a unique position to do something to save your state from falling deep into crisis. So what is the solution? Let me share with you the California experience. Back in 1975, California's legislators were in the same position as you are today. In response, they enacted a comprehensive package of reforms that included a $250,000 per claim limit on non-economic damages, abolition of joint liability so damages are fairly allocated based on one's percentage of fault, periodic payment of future damages to make sure that the money is available to a patient when he or she needs it, and limits on attorney contingency fees so that the injured party receives more of the award. The AMA strongly advocates California style reform because they have proven effective for 30 years in stabilizing medical liability premiums and protecting patient access to health care. Let's look at some of the facts. Since enactment of micro premiums for physicians' medical liability insurance have stabilized in California, in fact, since 1996, premiums for physicians in California have increased 245% compared to 750% across the country. California reforms have also reduced the time it takes to settle a claim by 33%. This not only decreases the cost of litigation, it also means injured patients receive awards much faster in California. Peer-reviewed economic literature also confirms that placing limits on non-economic damages are effective in reducing claims payment and stabilizing medical liability premiums. One study found that reasonable limits on non-economic damages reduced premiums for general surgeons by 13% in the year following enactment of that reform and by 34% over the long term. Similar results were found for obstetricians, gynecologists, and general practitioners. Caps on non-economic damages have also been found to reduce insurer payouts by 31%, while caps on total damages reduce payouts by 38%. Finally, reports from various government entities also confirm that California-style reforms will reduce losses and health care costs. A report by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services found that micro-style reforms, including a cap on non-economic damages, could reduce health care costs nationally between $70 billion to $126 billion per year. When medical liability premiums are lower, more physicians will be able to stay in practice, thus improving the supply of physicians in a state and preserving patients' access to health care. In fact, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality found that states with caps on damages had an average of 12% more physicians per capita than states without caps. The AMA unequivocally supports reforms that have been proven effective in stabilizing medical liability premiums, including those reforms found in MICRA. We also support state efforts to explore other types of reforms that, if structured properly, can have the potential for success at the state level, such as pretrial screening panels and strong expert witness requirements. Some states have enacted these additional reforms to bring common sense back to the judicial system by reducing the number of non-meritorious lawsuits and ensuring that witnesses who testify in a medical liability case are experts in the field and not simply a hired gun. We urge you to also consider these reforms as incremental steps and as part of the broader package of reforms found in the bill supported by the Oregon Medical Association. The AMA and the Oregon State Medical Association are committed to seeking fair and reasonable legal reforms to stabilize the medical liability insurance market. Indeed, we will continue to fight for reforms at the federal level. However, it is critically important that states like Oregon continue to move forward and enact strong medical liability reform laws to complement any reform achieved at the federal level. In fact, your passage of a strong patient safety voluntary reporting bill illustrates how state action can complement federal action. We also will continue urging Congress this year to enact strong federal patient safety, a strong patient safety law. Again, let me thank you for the opportunity to share my experiences and those of the American Medical Association with you. I will be more than happy to respond to any of your questions.
Thank you, Dr. Palmisano. Your testimony kind of comes ahead of discussion of this issue in the legislature. We're going to have a number of projects and approaches being developed to this issue, and so you're kind of getting in ahead of the discussion. But your point of view will be helpful as we move forward.
Thank you, Senator.
Are there questions from the committee?
I just have one.
Senator Ringo?
Thank you very much, Doctor, for testimony today. And how are you doing, Dr. Moorhead?
Senator?
You are the past president of the AMA. I'm just curious, how much of its funding does the AMA get from the insurance industry?
How much of the funding does AMA get from the insurance industry?
Correct.
We don't get any funding from the insurance industry. All of our funding is publicly put forth to the House of Delegates every year in our report to the House of Delegates. We get dues money. It's $420 a year per doctor for a regular membership.
Okay.
It's less for the students. We also have a subsidiary which sells health insurance type things. It's a for-profit subsidiary. And we also have the world famous collection of journals, Journal of the American Medical Association, the archives, and so on.
The reason I asked, just to follow up, I'm sure, is I understood that the Oregon Medical Association received a substantial share of its funding from the insurance industry, and I didn't know if that was also true for the AMA.
No, the AMA doesn't receive any funding from the insurance.
Okay. Dr. Moorhead's about to pitch in.
Well, I'd certainly like to correct that. The Oregon Medical Association is almost entirely funded by membership dues. There is some fund allocated by one insurance company that goes to loss prevention programs specifically, and that's monitored and reported, but it only goes to loss prevention programs.
Okay.
The entire operation is basically dues funded.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Pisanski?
Thank you. Doctor, thank you for being here. I guess this is my first time. I apologize. I got in here a little bit late, so I'm not sure if you already identified this pamphlet that were at our table from AMA. On the bottom it says Advocacy Resource Center. Can you first tell us about the Advocacy Resource Center?
Yes, sir. The Advocacy Resource Center is part of the American Medical Association, and it was developed to be of assistance to states to share the experience from one state to another state, and that's the it's housed at the AMA office in Chicago. The main office is in Chicago. We have a small office in New Jersey for publishing, and then we have a small office also in Washington, about 150 employees in Washington, about 850 in Chicago.
Would it be fair to say that this is a center that's there for the AMA to make certain its message gets out not only on a national level but also at the state level?
It's what the Advocacy Center is, to advocate for patients and physicians and to have information. It's an information sharing. For instance, one of the things that's done at the AMA through our resources, if we believe that managed care, and we do believe that managed care has become consolidated to the point where they have monopsony power and can influence decision-making for patients or override the doctor and the patient, then we put together something called a market concentration study, which is either the third or fourth edition now. It's available through the AMA website. We present that to the Justice Department, Federal Trade Commission. So these types of things are done at the AMA as information. We try to gather information. Also in that document, you'll see medical liability reform now document, started off around 40 pages, up to 70 pages. You can always get the latest version at the AMA website. We try to be a resource to reporters, to physicians, to patients, and we believe that people who use that data won't be embarrassed. We get good references and have been checked out.
One last question, if I could, on the center.
Please.
Regarding the center, what's the funding basis, or what makes up the funding for the center itself?
The center itself is funded through AMA dues. And again, we have a very open process. We put out everything, the funds and everything, to the House of Delegates every year. And in fact, the House of Delegates, they have very strong willed. Everything that I present as policy, if I drop dead today, I hope I don't live a little longer, I'll see my grandkids more after this tour of duty is over. But there'll be somebody else giving the same policy, whatever's voted upon, the new president or the president coming in, the president-elect.
Thank you. I have a couple other questions, if I could.
Please.
I had the opportunity to participate at NCSL, which is the National Conference of State Legislators. They had a forum last, I think it was last spring, and I got had the opportunity to present what Oregon had done for the rural medical crisis that we saw. While I was there, they had a presentation saying that about half the states are considered to be in crisis for health issues and not having the coverage. But what I also learned was of those half of those states, half of them also have caps already in place. I'm wondering if you could share with us, because I know part of your presentation was talking about the use of caps, which we know has been voted down in this state twice now, I believe, and most recently the last time, but also knowing that if half the states that are deemed to be in crisis already have caps, how would that be beneficial?
Yes, sir. That's a terrific question, and that question comes up all the time. The answer to that question from AMA's perspective is that you have to compare apples to apples and not apples to oranges. For instance, in California, it's a fixed cap for the incident. It doesn't increase with the cost of living. It doesn't matter how many doctors are involved in the case, how many, if it's a death case, it doesn't matter if there are four heirs, five heirs, or whatever, that members of that family. It's a 250 fixed non-economic cap. Missouri is a cap that's frequently brought up. It's a cap that grows with the cost of living index. It's a cap per doctor per claimant, so you could have multiple caps in any given case. West Virginia is also one of the states that's included in the states with caps. They just recently changed their law about a year and a half ago. Prior to that, they had $1 million cap. The actuaries predicted a long time ago. In fact, the various organizations of actuaries have predicted what works with a non-economic cap. You know, 250 cap works, 350, 400, 500 worked in your state. And then when it was overturned and the rates went back up. So we know what works and what doesn't work. So in order to be fair, the six states that are stable for many years on this map, I think you have that in your packet there, that's Louisiana, Indiana, New Mexico, Colorado, Wisconsin, and California. And there's a constant there amongst those states. They don't have a cap per doctor per claimant. They don't have $1 million non-economic cap. So that would be a short answer. That document also goes into more detail about that, the larger document called Medical Liability Reform Now. Thank you.
And one other question.
Yeah,
and Doctor, I guess the one thing I didn't hear in your presentation, which was very impressive to me when we were going through our panel during the interim, is the impact of having physicians be able to say, I'm sorry, to a patient after something goes wrong. And based on the study, I forget what state it was, if it was Colorado, Florida, or Pennsylvania. There was one of the states, I apologize not knowing which state it was, where they actually showed remarkable results as actually curbing the number of suits that are actually filed. I'm wondering if the AMA has taken a position on that type of approach, because if you can keep them from coming in the door, and it seems to me that that might be a way that we might want to try to make certain that people understand what may have gone wrong without having the doctor be considering being liable just because they said, I'm sorry.
Another question, right, at the heart of the matter. The American Medical Association believes, first off, if anybody makes a mistake, if there's an error, we believe that you should tell the patient. You should be absolutely upfront with the patient, tell the patient. JCHO recommends that, National Patient Safety Foundation, that the AMA founded in 1996, fully operational in 1997, also has the same policy. And the states that you mentioned, there are at least four, maybe five by now, I don't know the exact number, but I have them listed in my PDA. We think that's good. We think Colorado has shown some leadership there with that, and we think that's good. And the important thing is that this could be something that the doctor could tell the patient, and it wouldn't be incriminating the doctor in any way. But good communications is essential for the patient-physician relationship, not only when you're treating the patient, but after something less than ideal occurs. At the National Patient Safety Foundation, which I'm privileged to be a member of that board since its inception, and their attorneys, physicians, human factors experts, nurses, consumers on this board. They have only one mission, measurably improve patient safety. And we had hearings around the United States, not hearings, but actually town hall meetings. And they were different in every city. We would let the city decide how they wanted to do it. And repeatedly what the patients would say as they went to the microphone, they would say they wanted three things, really two things. And the first thing they wanted was they wanted to know what happened to their mother, their baby. They wanted to know what happened. Why did this happen? The second thing they wanted to know, what was being done at the institution, the facility, to prevent this from happening to someone else. And the third thing, which was extra, but they would like that too, is they'd like somebody to say they were sorry. And so we try to learn from that, that that's very, very important. And it's just good human behavior. It's good civility.
Thank you for your time and
Thank
your responses.
You. Dr. Palmisano, you mentioned California with the caps, the $250,000 rigid caps, but doesn't California also have an arbitration process that prevents cases from getting into the system?
Some of the places, like the, I think the Kaiser Permanente, they've had a long-standing arbitration agreement, and many states have passed laws that allow that. For instance, my home state of Louisiana, when we passed our comprehensive bill in 1975, the patient and the physician could opt into a binding arbitration. We have a medical review panel that's mandatory before a case can be filed. However, if the doctor and the patient elected at the start of treatment that they would skip a medical review panel if there was a controversy and instead go into binding arbitration, then that would be available.
Okay, so basically to get that kind of process you just need enabling legislation and then it's decided at the by institution
yes.
or by
I mean most of the cases in to our knowledge in California are not put into a binding arbitration, but the I think the Kaiser Permanente has been a pioneer in using that method.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there other questions? Senator Whitson.
Chair Burdick, Dr. Palmisano, I find it simply obscene that Oregon's medical professionals are forced to select and to manage their medical careers and practices by a medical liability insurance premium menu. And that's essentially in rural Oregon's what's happening. Some of the older physicians about my age are limiting their practices. We don't do enough that anymore. We don't do that procedure enough anymore, or the liability for that particular procedure has gone up to the point where it's no longer conceivable for us to do it. And you mentioned that in your presentation, and it is especially true in the rural areas. In the debate that we had last year on our medical malpractice caps, and unfortunately that devolved into a debate with couched in terms of wealthy physicians and rich lawyers, and I think the point was largely missed that there's a system that is broken, and that system that's broken is not just limited to the medical field. In every area of commerce in Oregon, we're having the same problem. I know a newspaper editor, an older lady that's had this, it's a weekly newspaper, she's been there for 40 years and been the manager or the editor for 39 and a half or whatever, you know. And she was, had her liability premiums tripled in the last 2 years. I know of one builder in Klamath Falls that's out of business because he said simply he could not afford the liability, a house builder, and two others that have merged in order to manage the system for a little while longer. So the point in this dissertation is that I think that you know, to be effective maybe in addressing this issue in our medical field, we need to incorporate it in a little broader area and give the rest of the people who are really involved in it and where this liability insurance premiums are killing their businesses and practices also to become more involved in it.
Well, certainly that's the approach taken in many places, and each state has to decide, and the proponents and opponents have to decide who's going to be on the team, so to speak, with that. But if we can get everybody speaking together, the bottom line on all of this is that it's patient access to care. Texas passed, not only did Texas pass the law again in Texas that their Supreme Court had declared unconstitutional, but they said they were going to change their constitution. And so they got involved, they changed the constitution. I think the date, I know it was in September of 2003, I think it was September 13th. I was in Helsinki, Finland, representing the American Physicians at the World Medical Association, and I did some, did a visit there to Texas before the vote, and they promised to call me, and I got a call at 4 a.m. Helsinki time on my international cell phone that AMA gave me to use in case they needed to reach me, and they said we've won. And there was about 32,000 votes, perhaps. But I remember a Democratic representative in South Texas the next morning made a quote in the newspaper, and he said, the reason I voted for it is because I'm tired of hearing my constituents tell me they can't find a doctor in their hour of need. And over half of the counties in Texas didn't have an obstetrician. Since they passed that law and changed the Constitution, on January 1, 2004, Medical Liability Trust, which insures the largest number of doctors, 40% of the doctors in Texas, they lowered their rates 12% January 1. Later in the year, another 5%, 17%. Another carrier just filed to lower the rates. And Governor Perry has just recently made a tour of the state talking about all the insurers that want to come in into Texas. And Texas did it with a whole coalition of people, as you point out. It was a coalition. Now, in other places, Georgia, Florida, they just had Florida pass a very strict contingency fee. It's 30% of the first $250,000, and after that, the patient gets 90% of any money over that. They did it directly with a vote by the people. In Georgia, about a week or two ago, they just passed, and the governor signed a law akin to the Texas law, which is slightly different than California.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you mentioned Mississippi has just changed their laws.
Yes, Mississippi too. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Absolutely. Other questions? Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here in your lovely state. Wonderful people. Thank you very much. I saw that fish on the wall. We were in the wrong room for a moment, and it reminded me back in Louisiana. I saw a man pulling up a fish. Yeah. So I thought I was back home again to buy you.
Well, enjoy the rest of your travels. Thank you very much. We'll close the informational meeting, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 253. Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 253 comes to you from the Joint Interim Judicial Committee and enacts a new interstate compact for the supervision of juvenile offenders and runaways who travel across state lines. If enacted, this will take effect when 35 states adopt the compact. And Mr. Rick Masters is here from the Carlson State Government.
Madam Chair,
committee. A little bit of a delay getting here.
Yes. Thanks to Northwest. Northwest, I mean. Madam Chair, I'm special counsel for the Council State Government.
Can you give your name for the record?
Rick Masters.
Thank you.
And the compact for juveniles that is the subject of this bill is actually an amendment to an existing interstate compact that Oregon and every other state is currently a member of. But it was adopted back in the 1950s before we had interstate highway systems and reliable, readily accessible air transportation, although I would argue today that maybe we don't have as accessible an air transportation system as we like to think. But certainly you can get across the country relatively rapidly in a way that you couldn't back in the 50s. The numbers of juveniles have increased dramatically. The last year for which we have figures indicates that there are in excess of 30,000 juveniles that have been placed and are tracked under the existing compact to the extent they can be. We've certainly had more sophisticated types of crimes being committed by increasingly younger juvenile offenders. And we have the change in the criminal justice landscape where many types of offenders that are now subject to various types of monitoring and registration, sex offenders and what have you, were not problematic or were not being dealt with in the same way or at all in the 1950s. More importantly, this mechanism has reached a stage where in many states it simply is not operating to track or supervise these juveniles the way that they should be. In response to many of these problems, the Council of State Governments and the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, which is a department of the U.S. Department of Justice, convened an advisory group in the year 2000. And we sought to bring together representatives of juvenile judges associations, prosecutors, the existing representatives of the Interstate Compact, administrators for the juvenile compact, representative of the various legislative, executive branch, and attorney general organizations, NAG, a representative from the National Conference of State Legislatures. We had police officers, representatives of organizations of police officers, and other interested juvenile justice stakeholders to look at the problems of the current Interstate Compact for Juveniles and to recommend solutions. That led to a comprehensive amendment, which you find before you in the legislation that Oregon is currently considering. 22 states have now passed this new compact. At least 10 others have introduced it during the current legislative session. And there are really about five areas that I'll just summarize in order to be brief that are dealt with that are problematic in the existing compact, which this legislation seeks to address. First of all, it codifies some inconsistencies that have arisen since the original Interstate Compact for Juveniles was adopted in 1955. During the intervening 50 years, on three different occasions, there were piecemeal amendments that were attempted to regulate runaways, to regulate the rendition of juveniles, and to regulate confinement. Unfortunately, these three amendments were not adopted by all states. In fact, less than half of our states in our country have adopted all three of these amendments. So there is a very real argument, valid argument, that we really may not have an agreement currently because not everyone's on the same page, so to speak. So this legislation seeks to address that by bringing those within the ambit of the same bill adopted by all the states that adopt the new compact. Secondly, and equally troublesome, is the lack of enforcement. There really are no teeth in the current compact to require states to do the job of supervision and tracking that they are supposed to do. And while in the beginning perhaps the general person's agreement would work, this compact, much like its adult counterpart, the Adult Offender Compact, really has had some serious breakdowns because of failure of states to comply with the obligations of tracking these juveniles. Thirdly, the rulemaking under the existing compact is provided for. In fact, there's about 20 pages worth of rules that the current compact has promulgated. Unfortunately, there are no standards set forth in the current compact that you and other legislators would expect an administrative type agency to use in adopting their rules. No provisions for public comment, no provisions for due process in the rulemaking process, for publishing those rules, and for dealing with rulemaking in the way that any state administrative agency would be required to deal with it. This legislation addresses that problem and incorporates much of the administrative law that you would expect of one of your state administrative agencies, and in fact makes reference to the State Administrative Procedures Act as being the guideline for rulemaking that this compact will engage in concerning the regulation and supervision of these juveniles. Equally importantly, and perhaps as important as any single innovation here, is to streamline and update the communication system between the states about these juveniles that are being tracked. In many cases, states are sending information by the U.S. mail. In many cases, when that information arrives, it may be weeks or months after the juvenile has already transferred, and that person may have, for all practical purposes, dropped off the radar screen. This provides for uniform regulatory standards, including provision for information systems that reflect the computer age that we live in, and to utilize existing technology that all states possess, but they're not currently applying in this arena of the transfer of juveniles. And then finally, provision for coordination of the other compacts that have relationships with this one. The Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision, for instance, which Oregon is a member of, the new Adult Offender Compact, will be coordinated in the administration of this compact with that one. And in addition, the Interstate Compact for the Placement of Children, which in some respects does on some types of placements have occasions where these compacts overlap. So that's kind of the high points of the legislation that you have before you. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Does the definition of compacting state, it says, means any state that has enacted the enabling legislation for this compact, does that define the states that are already in the compact as of 1955, or just the ones that that approved this amendment?
No, this is really starting from square one, where we're asking the states to enter a new agreement.
Okay, so this would completely replace the 1955.
Yes, ma'am. And as of today, we have 22 states that have enacted the legislation, and at least 10 more that have introduced.
Now, we did something about 4 years ago. We tried to take this issue up, and it didn't go anywhere. Was that because it was more in the nature of an amendment, or was that the same general approach?
Well, I'm not sure what the concern was at that time. The first legislative year, I believe, in which introductions occurred was about 2001, and I can't remember if this bill was here at that time or not. I do know I was here on a prior occasion addressing a committee of the Oregon Legislature.
Maybe council could respond to that.
And Chair, members of the committee, 4 or 5 years ago was the Adult Compact.
Yes.
CSG also put together. You may remember some discussion this issue during the interim, and our legislative council's office had lots of questions about the original draft. And in a subsequent draft, those issues were taken care of.
On the juvenile.
On the committee. There were some. One of the difficult things in a state compact is it's also in the nature of a contract among and between the states. And there's a tipping point where if you change the language so much so that you no longer have a contract. Every legislature has its own style of drafting and its own standards of drafting. When the original draft went down to the Legislative Council's office, they had probably 24 questions concerning ambiguities, questions. When I talked to Mr. Masters and showed him the memo, he said that would, in his opinion, we could make those changes without violating what is an ambiguous area of a contractual relationship. So the draft that you have before you incorporates the suggestions that we had from Legislative Council's office to put the bill more in keeping with our drafting style.
Okay, thank you. Senator Pruzanski.
Thank you. Mr. Master, thank you for being here. I appreciate having the opportunity to actually be part of the presentation that the organization did for the compact. And I also wanted to thank you for working with our legislative council and addressing some of the concerns we have for the state.
Thank you, Senator.
Chair Burdick, Mr. Masters.
Yes.
As I read this, this creates an interstate commission that would be conveyed authority to write statutes and levy taxes on participating states. Is that correct?
Well, it would promulgate regulations the way any other state administrative agency would do so, but only as authorized by the state enabling legislation and only within the confines of this narrow area of regulating the transfer of juveniles from one state to another. The only thing that any member state is giving up, Senator, is the right to act unilaterally. Everyone's agreeing that for certain purposes we will work as a group of states to define the population of juveniles that would be eligible for transfer under this agreement. And that's primarily what it does. It really doesn't wholesale give any other authority to do anything except regulate what the existing compact already regulates, but hopefully to do it in a better and more efficient way. And we believe that the accountability here under this new legislation is actually greater than what you have under the current one, because there aren't any standards listed in the current law, yet the compact administrators are empowered to band together and make regulations with no oversight or direction from the legislature.
Follow-up, Chair.
Follow-up.
Then essentially you're seeking statutory authorization to do what you're already doing, and then to be able to create, as you put it here, assessments on the states that are binding on the states.
It does create a provision for assessments for the central management function of the compact, which each state is currently doing, although under the new legislation that due structure would increase. I think under the current compact, the staff of this body really consists of full-time state employees of the various states, and there really isn't a staff to support their work, which has been one of the problems that has led to some of the breakdowns under the statute. Now, we did include a fiscal note with some of the materials that CSG put together, which I don't know if the committee has circulated, but I know it's been made available to council, and I know Senator Prozanski has seen that, just giving our best estimate of what that new due structure would consist of.
Then it does, in fact, would in fact give the commission authority to levy a tax on the state.
Well, it would give the commission authority to ask for an appropriation. You certainly would be in a position, I suppose.
The word chair says levy, sir.
Sir?
The word chair says levy.
Well, it does give the authority to the commission to publish a budget and to ask the states under law to submit due payments. That's correct, Senator.
Thank you, sir.
Council, did you want to add to this?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Wilson, interstate compacts are, I guess from a legal viewpoint, particularly for a lawyer, a very intriguing area. It is recognized in the United States Constitution that states can enter into compacts among and between themselves. One of the first issues is it within the interstate compact or not? Assuming that it is, you have an ability to enter an agreement where the agreement can supersede the state constitution, it can supersede state law because of the United States Constitution. You've raised the issue about a levy. The same issue was addressed in the adult compact, and I believe that we took care of it, and I believe it's also in here, and I think it's in Section 8, on that issue about how we fund it. And I believe the agencies involved will put money aside to meet their dues in advance, because there is a provision in the Oregon Constitution about what you just mentioned, levying taxes beyond the scope of our budget. So that was addressed in the adult compact, and I'm pretty sure it was addressed here. As I said, this is a very unique area. I think Oregon is probably a member of about 20 to 30 interstate compacts. I think the best example is the one between Oregon and Washington as it relates to Columbia River. We have them as it relates to children, dependent children. We have it as it relates to adult offenders. That's the last one we dealt with.
There's a interstate compact between Oregon and Washington, Oregon and California, regarding the water and the Klamath River also. But that commission neither has the authority to levy taxes, or is there a decision binding on the... their decision is only binding to the extent that it is authorized by state law.
Council?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's probably correct. I remember 4 years ago looking at that particular compact. I don't remember the details, but it may very well go to sort of listen to the terms of the interstate compact.
Sure. Good discussion. Did you have anything more to add?
I was going to say, Madam Chair, I've got a list of compacts of which Oregon is a member, and I believe there are approximately 23. Including the Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision, which does have a similar due structure, which was adopted by the state of Oregon.
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see in the staff member summary it says that the commission, rather the force and effect of statutory law, are binding upon the compacting states unless the majority of these state legislators reject the rule. So am I reading that correctly to say that if we were to do this and this commission sets something that the state legislature of Oregon disagrees with and the governor or the people of Oregon disagree with, and they were to pass a statute by either through the legislative process or through an initiative process, that statute would not go into effect because a majority of the states in the compact don't agree with that?
No, this simply refers to the right of the states to veto any rule that the compact commission might promulgate that the majority of states find objectionable.
Okay, that gets my question. But if a single state like Oregon finds a rule objectionable, they cannot say we don't agree with that and it takes a majority of the states in the compact to get out of a rule?
Well, there's a yes, but with an explanation. There is a provision for challenging any rule which can be done within the confines of the commission by any member state. And in fact, in the adult compact, we've already had one of those challenges by one of the member states that found a particular rule objectionable. So there is a mechanism within the legislation itself that does permit an individual state to challenge a rule with which it disagrees, although for the majority to act as part of the voting process by which those rules were approved, it would take a majority of the states to do it through a voting process. But a legal challenge could be made by in any state to any rule with which they were not satisfied.
Well,
follow up, please.
Thank you. So what, I mean, I can challenge any rule at the state of Oregon too, or any ruling that the tax court or Oregon Department of Revenue or that my property tax and like that, but if I challenge it and lose, what have I gained? And so what my question is, by challenging a rule, what good does that do a state?
Well, it provides an escape valve where you can legally propose some reasonable objection that you've not been able to convince the majority of the member states by debate should carry the day. It doesn't preclude an attack. I certainly would suspect that it would be a rare case where that would occur, because you've got to keep in mind that all this commission is concerned with is this very, very narrow area of how a juvenile is supervised and permitted to transfer from one state to another. And its mission in life is to serve as really the only public law that allows a juvenile offender who is in one state and needs to go to another state to go there and to be returned if he or she violates the terms of his supervision to the state which originally sentenced or adjudicated the juvenile status. So it's really a case where we're providing an alternative under the federal constitution where states continue to control the problem, as opposed to having federal legislation which would put this in the hands of some federal agency, and then we'd all be following rules that we might not necessarily agree with and have no input, and then be asked to pay for it. So I don't know any other way that it can be done, but it does have the effect that you're commenting on.
Yeah. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much, Mr. Masters. I think we're going to, I know you're going to stick around for the rest of the discussion. We have two more witnesses, and we may very well be dragging you back. So.
I'll be glad to stick around.
Thank you very much. We have Harry Gilmore and Karen Ondahl. The committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Harry Gilmore. I'm the manager of the Technical Assistance Unit for the Children, Adults, and Family section of the Department of Human Services. And the department has taken a neutral position on this bill. It supports the concept of the legislation. However, there is a minor fiscal impact that's already been discussed to some extent that is not part of the governor's recommended budget. And for that reason, we're taking a neutral position. Senate Bill 253 enacts the Interstate Compact for the Placement of Juveniles. As Mr. Masters pointed out, the existing compact was enacted in the 1950s, and it's widely acknowledged nationally that it is in need of reform. Passage of this legislation will enact the compact for Oregon, and once it is enacted nationally by a total of 35 states, it will go into effect. As Mr. Masters mentioned, between 20 and 25 states have already enacted this legislation. It's pending in the legislatures of 10 states, including Oregon. If Oregon is among the 35 states that pass the legislation, Oregon will be permitted to participate in the rulemaking process that will commence at that point. If Oregon is not one of the initial 35 states that passes it, we will be able to participate, but not as a voting member, in the promulgation of rules, of the new rules under the new compact. As I mentioned, there's a fiscal impact that's known with the passage of this bill. Right now, Oregon pays $400 annually in dues to the Association of Juvenile Compact Administrators. It's estimated by the Council on State Governments that our dues will increase to $22,000 annually under the new compact. The reason for that, in part, as Mr. Masters mentioned, is that the new compact creates a central management body with a paid staff, an executive director, legal counsel, and some program specialists. A lot of the dues that will be collected nationally will be in support of that standing body of employees. Another change will be that the dues will be assessed on a state-by-state basis, whereas right now, all 50 states, each state pays a standard amount. Dues will be assessed based on a formula that takes into account a state's overall population as well as the volume of interstate movement of juveniles in and out of the state. The increase, however, will not occur immediately upon passage of the legislation. As I mentioned, this legislation needs to be passed by 35 states before it goes into effect. So it's not expected that we will see any increase fiscally until sometime during the 2007-2009 biennium. There's also the potential that when the new rules are written, that way it will increase the workload associated with the administration of this compact, which may require the hiring of an additional half-time or full-time position. But it's impossible to know whether that will be necessary at this point, because the rules won't be written until after the passage of the legislation. It may be that there won't be any increase in workload, but there is that possibility. The only fiscal impact for which we're certain right now is the increase in dues. As I mentioned, our position is neutral on this legislation. We support the concept. It does come with a cost, and that cost is not part of the governor's recommended budget. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions on our position.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Whitsitt?
Chair Burdick, sir, just briefly, your testimony is, and then the assessment would go up about 1,000%. And then the other fiscal impact would be a likelihood of a 0.5 to 1 FTE. Is that correct?
It's possible that when the rules are written, that it will increase the workload associated with the administration of the compact. Right now, the majority of the work that goes into administering the existing juvenile compact is covered by a single full-time position with a negligible amount of support from a support level position as like an administrative assistant. it's possible that when the new rules are written, they'll be written in such a way that either it could potentially expand the population of juveniles that are covered by the compact, the rules, the complexity of the rules could increase to the point where the workload might go up substantially to the point that additional staff would be required to effectively administer the compact. However, since the rules will not be written until after 35 states have passed the measure, it's impossible to know whether that will actually occur or not. It may be that the workload stays the same. We can continue to administer the compact with a single FTE as we do currently.
Okay. Well,
and just so that I'm clear, these rules would be written by the commission and the assessment would be set by the commission. Is that true?
That's correct. Okay. Senator Whitsitt, Chair Burdick, they've done an initial assessment based on what is known about the interstate traffic back and forth between states. They've looked at the volume for each state individually, and they've looked at the overall population of each state. And based on those factors and using a formula proposed by council and state governments, Oregon's dues are estimated to increase to $22,000. That could be slightly off if population figures change between now and when the compact gets enacted, but that's probably a fairly good estimate based on the formula they proposed.
Follow-up?
Yes, just to be follow-up, that assessment is not necessarily fixed at about $22,000, or the commission could change that in the future. Is that correct?
Chair Burdick, Senator Whitsitt, that is correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe Mr. Masters would be willing to come up and just explain to us briefly why we need so much more staff to deal with this compact than the old compact.
Well, a lot of this will pertain to the information system. All states have computers, but they don't all talk to each other for all purposes. And so a fairly sophisticated software design would have to be created and serviced from a central location to make sure that all of the states are getting the information that they're supposed to get, that the confidentiality of their information is properly protected, that those with a need to know it had access to it, but those that did not or did not have authorization could not become part of the system. Currently, there is no meaningful way in which states can communicate this data electronically, and it's having to be done by, as I said, snail mail or the regular U.S. Postal Service. The other issue would be backing up the states as they engage in a more complex process. When you make rules and go by the book, so to speak, and do things as a legislature would expect an administrative agency to do, you need to be sure that that process is properly prepared and serviced. So all of these meetings, national meetings, at least once a year, probably one or two meetings per year, would have to be properly staffed and serviced. There would be times when such things as technical education and assistance would be provided to states, and while the existing compact administrators are trying to do that training, they're really on a less than a shoestring budget and not able to do that as extensively as it really should be done. For instance, they have no meaningful outreach to judges or prosecutors or public defenders or others outside the system of juvenile compact administration, except as each state takes it upon itself to do that. And some states are doing a very good job, but there just aren't funds available to support that kind of education effort and maintaining that critical knowledge of how to properly service this instrument. So it's pretty much based on a limited staff of about six individuals that would include information, training, legal advice to the commission to make sure they're following the rules that they set forward for themselves.
And how much staff do you have now under the existing compact?
There is no staff. These administrators are coming together once a year and are all full-time employees of their respective states, and at the same time are trying to manage an instrument that really has legal and administrative consequences beyond the borders of the states. And it's they've been doing as good a job as can be expected under those circumstances, but it's just not getting the job done.
Okay, thank you. Why don't you stick around and take those other questions. Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Now, did I hear you correctly and say the first 35 states in get to write the rules? Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
The way the compact is written, a state needs to be a member of, needs to be a compacting state in order to participate in the rules. So it may be that 35 states initially pass the legislation that will enact the rulemaking process. As states come in after the 35th state have passed, they will be able to participate at the point at which the state passes the legislation. So the rulemaking process is set to commence as soon as 35 states have passed it. So if another state doesn't get on board at that point or shortly thereafter, their participation in the rulemaking will not begin until they are a member state by passage of this legislation. So
they will eventually be full participants, I think.
Assuming they pass the legislation at some point.
Yeah, we both understood it that first 35 are in and everybody else is out.
Well, there is a timeline associated with the rulemaking that says that the rulemaking will commence as soon as 35 states have passed the legislation, and it will, the beginning rules need to be completed within 12 months. So if a state may not have the opportunity to pass the legislation during those 12 months, and so if they're unable to do so, then they would not participate.
But if you have 38 states that sign on all about the same time, you'll have 38 states on the rulemaking.
Chair Burdick, that is correct.
But could a state also come in a year, two, 3 years after, once they see the rules in place and see whether or not they like the rules, and then come in versus be there in the front end?
Senator Beyer, it would be optional for a state to pass the legislation
at any point and become a member.
Could you?
Senator,
but you don't get to participate in actually drawing the rules up, which could include what the fee or what the dues are going to be.
But on the other hand, the way I see this is if you're one of the first 35 in, the rules are in, you can't get back out.
Senator Beyer, I should clarify, there is a provision within the bill that allows for withdrawal from the compact by repealing the legislation that enacted it.
Yep, Madam Chair.
Senator Walker.
Senator Beyer, that's on page 11, line 2. Read that part.
I know we've had at least one state, I believe it was North Dakota, that put a sunset provision so they could see if they wanted to stay in or not. I don't know whether that's something you want to consider or not, but that has been done at least one case that I'm aware of. I think that the real problem will be, where do you send your offenders? After the new compact is in place, if you're not a member of the agreement, then you don't have participation or the ability to send offenders to states that are members of the new regime, and perhaps more problematically, you don't have a way to keep kids out of your jurisdiction if you're not a member. I'm not necessarily suggesting that a state would act in bad faith, but there'd be no mechanism to keep kids out if you weren't a member of the new compact.
Okay. Thank you. This is probably a good segue into Ms. Andahl. Welcome to the committee.
Hello. Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Karen Andahl. I'm with the Oregon Youth Authority. And the Youth Authority is also taking a neutral position on this bill. Our agency does see the need to standardize, build in accountability to the interstate compact system. As we all know, as we have young juvenile offenders or older juvenile offenders who do leave states, there needs to be adequate public safety issues addressed, as well as accountability and reformation when they move from state to state. I need to clarify for the moment that actually the Department of Human Services is the administrator of the interstate compact, current compact in the state of Oregon, and that is by current statute. There has been discussion about the appropriateness for the juvenile portion of the compact to move and be transferred to being administered by the Oregon Youth Authority, because we do deal specifically with juvenile offenders and work with county juvenile departments in that regard. So we're having conversations at an administrative level about that issue, and maybe working with council and others to use this as a vehicle when appropriate or if appropriate to discuss that transfer piece.
Would you need legislation to do that?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, it appears at this point that we would, since the statute, current statute for the compact specifically mentions Department of Human Services administrator as the administrator of the compact in Oregon.
Okay, well, we'll discuss this more as time goes on. Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Thank you all very much. Do you have any more questions, Council?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, no, I don't.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for coming. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 253. Kelly Sky, aren't you worried about this one?
Yes, thank you.
So we will open a hearing on Senate Bill 306.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate
Bill 306 comes to you from the request of Senator Bill Morissette, increases the criminal fine for knowingly selling or giving an alcoholic beverage to a person under 21. For first offense, to a fine of at least $1,000. For second offense, for a fine of at least $2,500. And for a third or subsequent offense, a fine of at least $5,000. And limits the penalty of those who are licensed or appointed under the Oregon Liquor Control Commission.
Okay. Why don't we take Benita Howard and Joanne Fairchild? We don't have Senator Morissette in here, do we? No. Welcome to the committee. It's good to see you again,
Senator.
Ms. Howard. I'm glad to see your columns occasionally still appear in the paper.
This process, Senator, is sort of addictive, and even though you retire, you keep coming back from time to time.
Well, I'm glad you're still participating. Welcome.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Vanita Howard, and I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 306 as a representative of the Governor's Advisory Committee on Driving Under the Influence of Intoxicants. I won't belabor the numbers that we have on this, but we think that the consequences of young people driving with alcoholic beverages is pretty seriously reflected in all of the traffic deaths that we have on our streets and highways. In 2003, for example, 35 young people in the under 21 age group died in alcohol-involved crashes in Oregon. For the most part, these young people are inexperienced drivers, and they are also inexperienced drinkers. And that's a deadly combination, especially when you add youthful denial of the possibility of injury and death. More than 20 years ago, Oregon passed a law to allow courts to deny a driver license to a minor found to be in possession of an alcoholic beverage, and I've attached a copy of that law to this testimony. Unfortunately, this law is not utilized by the courts in many areas of the state. In 2002, for example, Oregon recorded more than 12,000 convictions for minor in possession, yet the courts ordered denial of a license for only 1,578 first-time underage drinkers and 647 second offenders. Those two figures were even lower in 2003. Senate Bill 306 attacks the problem from a different direction. It significantly increases the financial penalty for those who make it possible for minors to be in possession of alcoholic beverages. And repeat offenders would also face jail time. all states in the District of Columbia now have 21-year-old minimum drinking age laws, and it has been estimated by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration that these laws have reduced traffic fatalities involving drivers 18 to 20 years old by 13% and have saved an estimated 21,887 lives since 1975. In 2002, an estimated 917 lives were saved by those minimum drinking age laws. Effective as these laws have been by their measurements, however, we believe their effectiveness is reduced or at least thwarted by adults who willingly provide the alcoholic beverage, most often beer, to those who are underage. Stiffer penalties are, in our opinion, justified. We also urge that those concerned with this issue do whatever is necessary, however, to assure that the fines set in the law are not only imposed, but collected by the courts. That concludes my statement.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you. Welcome.
Welcome.
Common Nurses Talk Tough. One of the best names out there.
Chair Burdick and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, my name is Joanne Fairchild. I'm a trauma nurse coordinator responsible for injury prevention at Legacy Emanuel Hospital, and I've worked with trauma and emergency patients for the past, I hate to admit it, 28 years. I also had the Trauma Nurses Talk Tough About Saving Your Life program, and I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 306 to increase the penalty for people who furnish alcohol to our children. There is an increasing amount of research that makes it clear why underage drinking is such a problem to our kids, not only when they're teenagers, but as their lives progress. Pam Erickson from Oregon Coalition to Reduce Underage Drinking will be presenting some of that research, and I have attached some of it to my testimony. But I've witnessed over the years the negative consequences that this causes, not just when our kids get behind the wheel of a car, but in other decisions that they're making about their futures regarding crime, regarding violence, regarding sexual activity. And these bad decisions are leading to very negative consequences for them and our society. We now know part of it, and if any of you spend much time around a teenager, you know that even when they're not using a mind-altering chemical, they may have some difficulty with decision-making. And if you've ever watched them do something that you consider incredibly stupid and you ask them why they did that, they will tell you, I don't know, and they truly don't. And that has to do with prefrontal cortex development, which research is uncovering more and more of. And to have them put chemical in their brain when they're developing that very, very important part of their brain that has to do with judgment, reasoning, logic, and decision-making doesn't make any sense. We come down on the children, but we need to hold the adults responsible. I've been teaching classes for youth that have been cited for minor in possession of alcohol and other drugs, and also classes for school districts for kids that have been suspended from school or caught during school functions or on school property with alcohol or other drugs. And it's very clear in talking to them that they're getting their alcohol from adults, either directly or indirectly. I've included some information. We were collecting this information from youth attending our class where they were getting their alcohol. And a lot of it they get from a friend's home. I just talked to a 13-year-old in Salem last week at a juvenile court class who got drunk for the very first time at a friend's house. The friend's mother left the house knowing that these two young ladies, at least I know there were two, there may have been more, were going to be drinking mom's alcohol. This 13-year-old ended up in the emergency department with alcohol poisoning. She has since gone on to use other drugs, and a lot of our kids are getting their alcohol from older brothers, sisters, neighbors, whatever, and my belief is that it is the adult responsibility to be the safety net for our children. they're going to make bad decisions because of their brain development, and we have to make sure that their environment is safe. I tell the kids all the time that I wish that adults that furnished alcohol to them while their brains are still developing would go to prison, but a bigger fine would at least be helpful. However, I am asking for an amendment, and that is to allow, and I should have put in my testimony, first-time offenders, because a lot of adults don't know what the research is showing. They don't know about that brain development. They don't know about the increased level of addiction. The younger you are when you start drinking, the more likely you are to become addicted. So I would like some ability for the courts to send first-time offenders to get this education. We've been doing it for quite a while. I know that Oregon Partnership, the Oregon Coalition to Reduce Underage Drinking, has been doing similar education, and I'm volunteering to work with them to come up with a class that we do research on effectiveness to protect our children. But if you're concerned about that fine and people not being able to afford it the first time they offend, let's allow them an opportunity to learn why that was such a bad decision. Thank you very much, and I'm open to questions.
Thank you. Do you recommend that parents of teenagers who have, say, liquor cabinets just lock them up?
Yes. And we when we get the opportunity, our MIP classes, we give a big decrease in the amount that people are charged for the class if the parents attend, because we know these are environmental issues. Portland Public School Insight class, parents have to attend, so we do suggest that, but a lot of times it's those older brothers, sisters, cousins, friends that are also contributing to the problem. So,
thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time.
Why don't we have Pam Erickson, Dana Vitolins, I mispronounced your name again, but I'll learn, and John Steubenval. Welcome to the committee. You can fight over who's going to start. Pam, why don't you start, because they mentioned your research.
I'll be happy to. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pamela Erickson. I'm director of the Oregon Coalition to Reduce Underage Drinking. It's a project at the Oregon Partnership funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and our purpose is to advocate for public policies that are designed to reduce underage drinking. Today, underage drinking is a very serious problem in our state. One of the trends that we find truly frightening is the fact that younger and younger kids are drinking, and drinking a lot of alcohol. We regularly monitor the rate of eighth graders drinking, and it always shocks me when I realize that almost 30% of our eighth grade students in Oregon report drinking in the last month. Certainly when I was in school, juniors and seniors drank, but in the eighth grade, it just didn't happen very much. And we now know, we now have a great deal of research that tells us how bad that is. One of the statistics that we've learned is that if you start drinking before age 15, your chances of being an addict as an adult are four times greater than if you had waited until age 21. You've heard about the developing brain. Since we've had MRIs, we've been able to see what happens to the adolescent brain as a child ages into adulthood and what the impact of alcohol is on that developing brain. And we find that it does create impairment of the brain, which damages a child's ability to function socially and to function academically. Underage drinking is associated with all of the leading causes of death of our young people. It is surprising how often adults furnish alcohol to young people. A couple of months ago, there was an incident on the coast where a mother furnished her daughter, her 16-year-old daughter, and friend with a half gallon of vodka. Those two young ladies ended up in the hospital with severe alcohol poisoning, and they're lucky to be alive. It always shocks me when parents do that kind of thing. Some parents do it out of a sense that it's a safer approach to furnish a party at my own home where my children and their friends can come and drink. At least they won't be out on the street. We have a new study that says that's a very foolish idea, because what happens is those kids get the idea that drinking is okay. And the study found that children whose parents or friends' children's parents supplied parties were twice as likely to binge drink when they were away from home. So that's really a very poor idea. In actuality, most parents do a very good job, and they're trying very hard to raise their children in a very difficult environment. Kids encounter a mass market. They are bombarded by ads from the media. It is very difficult to raise children these days, as I'm sure all of you know. There really is no excuse for an adult furnishing alcohol to a child. And we feel that there needs to be a very strong message sent to those adults who do furnish children. And we believe that an increase in penalties will send that strong message. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? John, why don't you go next?
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Good afternoon. My name is John Stuenbaugh. I'm the Communications Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. You've already heard a lot about the problem of underage drinking, and certainly OLCC would concur that it's a serious issue in our state, and it's been a regulatory priority for the OLCC for a number of years now. I'd like to just briefly address a couple of points. The first point is that I think what Senate Bill 306 tries to do for the first time that I'm aware of is make a distinction between those who intentionally, willfully furnish alcohol to a minor and those who in an employment-based situation in effect make a mistake. What the proposed legislation does is to, on the second page of the legislation, beginning on line 12, really carry forward the existing fine for those who would, in effect, make a mistake in an employment-based situation. So this legislation would create a distinction between those who intentionally provide alcohol and subject those folks to a much higher fine than it would to a store clerk, for example, who sells a six-pack of beer to, you know, a 20-year-old with a fake ID in what we would presume would be a mistake. We think this is a very good thing. The second point I'd like to address is there's been some discussion of, certainly most parents are trying to do the right things these days. Education is clearly an important component of that. There are also, however, and unfortunately, are some adults who really don't care and who furnish alcohol to minors for some other type of consideration, a couple bucks for a six-pack, some of the beer from a full case, for example. We think in those situations, the higher fine level is a very appropriate deterrent and certainly sends the right signal to folks who would willfully commit this type of crime. Today we start these fines, furnishing alcohol to a minor, it's a Class A misdemeanor. The first level conviction fine is $350. This is a very, very small amount of money in our opinion. Under current statute in Oregon today, those convicted of a Class A misdemeanor can be fined up to $6,250. Furnishing alcohol to a minor starts at $350. Quite a distinction there. So we think it's entirely appropriate to substantially raise the fine that folks are subject to for this type of willful action. And I'd be happy to respond to questions.
Thank you. Senator Pisanski.
Thank you, John. I guess I'm going to run through a couple of questions. I know there are going to be some other people talking, reviewing some of the literature that's here as to disparity of different people. You've actually mentioned some of it in your own testimony. I'm wondering if we shouldn't maybe relook at this and rethink how we are treating individuals who are not licensees or agents of those licensees who are also maybe under mistake believe that they were not doing anything wrong. Because the way I see it now, it's if you're not an agent or a person that's operating under an agency agreement, you have the same fine as someone who's intentionally doing it who knows it. And I'm also wondering, the numbers, I'm not sure who actually brought up the numbers as to establishing, looking at the disparity, you're going from 350 to 1,000, that's over just about three times as great. Then when you look at some of the other amounts that are in here, it's much less than that on a proportionate level of increasing. I'm wondering if you would give us your opinion as to first whether or not we should try to have equity within this policy for all of those who did not have knowledge or thought and good faith that they were not violating the law. And if so, let me just start with that.
Madam Chair, Senator Krasanski, quite honestly, I'm not entirely sure I understand your question. Are you speaking to the distinction between a willful and an unintentional act?
Right. And my understanding, there's actually another breakout from that. It's whether you are an agent or operating under, let's say, the selling at a grocery store, or if you're at a bar and you think that you are doing unintentionally providing them alcohol, they fall under the first conviction of a fine of $350. But we don't have that for a citizen who's not an agent, etc. So to me, there seems some disparity there, and it seems to me you'd almost have a higher level a higher level standard for those who are actually in the business of providing alcohol to anybody. So it seems like if we're going to treat them at a lower level, it seems like we should also think about those who may fall in that same category, but for being an agent.
Madam Chair, Senator Brzezinski, I think without reading between the lines too much here, I think what the legislation essentially presumes is that those who are not in an employment-related or employment-based situation understand that they are in fact furnishing alcohol to a minor in probably the majority of cases. So, for example, my testimony speaks to, I believe it's 140 citations that OLCC wrote last year for furnishing alcohol to a minor. This would be what we would commonly call a shoulder tap situation, where you have an adult standing outside or a minor standing outside a convenience store, for example, approaching adults as they go in, asking them to buy beer, whatever it might be. In those situations, I think a reasonable person would understand, the reasonable adult in this situation would understand that we've probably got a minor here and I'm probably going to be furnishing alcohol to this minor. So I think that's the kind of assumptions that the legislation, again, this is not an agency request bill, so I'm, reading between the lines here to some extent, but would assume that to some extent this is the assumptions the legislation is making, that we do in fact have adults who would understand. You have a reasonable person here who would understand that this would be furnishing alcohol to a minor. So it would be a willful, intentional act in that situation.
But you're assuming intention by that without saying it, and I think that's probably part of the problem you're having, and it's probably the problem I'm having. And it would also, it seems to me, it would take into... it would wrap into this section the higher fines of a parent who maybe locked their liquor up and the kid found the key or whatever. It seems like that kind of person would be wrapped into this too. I mean, I don't see anything excluding that. So, food for thought. Did you want to follow up anything?
I'll wait. I've got a couple others, but I'll wait.
Okay. All right. Okay, why don't we wrap up with you? Thank you.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Dinah Vittelins. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and we are in support of Senate Bill 306. And I do not have anything to add other than that, other than to say that if you inserted a knowingly provision in subsection 2, that would not be a problem. I think most district attorneys and deputy district attorneys charge it. We've got to have a mental element, and we proceed that way. That's all I have.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Okay. Next, we will go to the other side of the discussion here, and Bill Perry, you're signed up as neutral. I don't know if you want to come up with this panel, you want to come up by yourself, but Steve Lanning, Kelly Skye, and Andrea Meyer, and Bill, you can either come up or wait, whatever you prefer.
I like sitting next to him.
Oh, you can go first, Kelly.
Good morning.
Or good afternoon, excuse me. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Kelly Skye, and I'm the legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And we oppose Senate Bill 306. What drew my attention to this bill was the raise in mandatory minimum sentence. That's a term that we will never support and will always oppose because not every person who commits any given offense is the same, and we elect judges to impose sentences as they see fit and to fit the crime or the violation, and we think that it's appropriate that they do so and that they have the discretion to impose the fine that they think is appropriate. And as the discussion has already come round to show the different types of offenses that can violate the provisions of this law. One that has not been mentioned under subsection 2, where it prohibits the selling, giving, or otherwise making available the alcoholic beverage, there's no requirement that the person who do that be 21. So this could be the high school student who has, a party at their house and has other folks. So we could be now applying these mandatory fines to a juvenile who gives somebody else perhaps their parents' liquor that they got out of the parents' liquor cabinet. That is a person for whom the $1,000 mandatory minimum fine may not be appropriate. And we could go on ad nauseum. The other example that I came up with is perhaps, on First Thursday in Portland, an art gallery that has wine out, and somebody who's under 21 comes in and serves themselves. Well, they've just made available to a person who's under 21 alcohol, and that may very well be different from the person who intentionally goes into the 7-Eleven and buys a case of beer for the kids in the parking lot. So for those reasons, we do oppose this bill for not giving the judge the ability to impose the fine that they see appropriate. We also disagree with the different impact for the people who are licensed, and as you've discussed earlier, that we do believe there should be a higher scrutiny on people who are licensed to sell alcohol as opposed to people who are not licensed.
Okay. Thank you very much. Andrea?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU. I know if I let Ms. Skye go first that she would basically cover all the points that the ACLU has concerns about and has done that quite well. So that's pretty much, I won't repeat what she just said.
All right. Thank we will you. Wait for questions for you. Mr. Lanning.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Steve Lanning. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO, and I'm here today for one of our larger affiliates, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local 555. They have 16,000 members in Oregon, and they represent about 10,000 grocery clerks. And our problem with the bill has to do with the reiteration of the current law that would affect grocery clerks who unknowingly sell alcoholic beverages to a minor. And our problem with it is that there's no distinction made on whether these folks are trained or not trained. There's no mandate for training grocery clerks. Some stores do it, some stores don't. And there's a lot of clerks that get caught up in OLCC stings that have never had the free training that's available and that's OLCC approved, and they end up losing their jobs or reduction in pay. And so that's our problem, maintaining the current penalty for those that unknowingly provide it or sell it, and making no distinction on whether they're trained or not trained. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Perry, you are signed up as a neutral on this, so we will see what a neutral sounds like here.
Members of the committee, my name is Bill Perry with the Oregon Restaurant Association. Chair Burdick, members, I appreciate the time to comment. Actually, this is one of those interesting bills that when we brought it up to my policy committee, they were all very excited about it. But I do think a couple of points that came up are kind of bear where they're falling on it. One of the problems we have is obviously a lot of times the establishment is the one that ends up carrying the burden of the fine just because the courts or whoever doesn't want to pursue the people that are committing the crime. Our guys agree with the fact that if a seller and a buyer are the ones that are basically violating it, they should be punished in some way. So we do like that part of the bill. A lot of times they're, because the courts have other things to do, just ignore that part of it, and then OLCC comes in and sanctions us for having a sale to a minor. And so if the buyer and the seller don't get punished and we do, it doesn't deter those parties from continuing to try. So we do like that part of the bill. But I think the first speaker and a couple of subsequent speakers have addressed what I consider the heart of the issue is the courts at this point, even though there's a mandatory suspension of a license, aren't doing it. Very few of them are doing it. So once again, you come to the standpoint of, I think there's laws on the books that help us deter these people, but they're not being enforced. And that's my only fear is I don't necessarily think the penalties and fines need to be increased. I think we need to find a way to enforce the current ones. That is kind of more of the problem. And just by raising those fines, I don't think encourages the court system to do it. I will say I've thrown out as an idea once, if you move that court or the license suspension process to an administrative hearing instead of a court hearing, much like they do with drunk driving, I think you'll have more of them that will be in place and the penalties will be stricter. I will say DMV probably won't appreciate that process, but I think it's finding a way to enforce the current laws is more of an issue to us than it is increasing the penalties. I think that's what we would kind of like to see is we need to punish the parties that are committing the crime, but just by raising those, I don't necessarily think does it. I think we need to try to address how do we get the people that are currently committing the crimes to fall under the current sanction schedule. So with that, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator Pradensky.
Yeah, Bill, I guess I want to just make a point on this stuff about the license suspension. It's for the juvenile, and so it would require that person to be coming in for minor in possession for them to actually be sanctioned that way as compared to if an adult was coming in for furnishing. That suspension doesn't go to them. Now, there was some testimony or attached to the testimony about some states, I guess, that may do that.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, the suspension is against the juvenile who has consumed or possessed the alcohol as compared to the person providing it to them. So,
yeah, Senator Pozanski, Chair Burdick, I agree with that, but my understanding, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, there is, though, when you look at the $350 fine today that's being issued against the provider, it's being increased. I don't think, at least to my knowledge, that those fines are being assessed today. So, you know, that was just the example that was given earlier about the licenses. I just don't think the fines are being assessed against some of the people that are providing them today. So once again, just increasing those fines isn't going to change the practice of the courts, from my opinion. I think it's how do we get those fines assessed to the people that are breaking the law. Does that answer your point?
I hear what you're saying, but I also know from my practice as a prosecutor that those fines are being assessed, at least in the courts I'm in, because the court knows that they are mandatory. In fact, it's kind of interesting because we classify it as a Class A misdemeanor, but we're telling the courts they have a fine of $350. So we're kind of giving them a slap on the wrist, but we're still keeping the criminal sanction that does in fact may have other impact on other parts of their life. I did want to follow up if I could and ask as to your concern for the licensee at such as a restaurant or a tavern. Do you think it might be better to have some type of a scale or some type of chart matrix that would be used that if, say, minors are served two or three times within a certain period of time at a given institution, that sanctions should then be imposed against the licensee, as compared to what I'm hearing your concern is that if the licensee's employee isn't being held accountable, but then OLCC's coming into the establishment is sanctioning them, that you think that that's not necessarily appropriate because the person who actually violated the law isn't being held accountable.
Yeah. Senator Prozinski, Chair Burdick, let me see if I understand. Right now we are being sanctioned, whether or not we had anything to do with the crime at all. And that's one of the things that frustrates our members, is we are continuing to get sanctioned. If, like, say we have a employee that sells to a friend and we catch him, we fire him. A lot of times they'll go down the street and get a job with another bar just because there isn't a system that helps track these permits. But I took the appropriate action by training them and firing, but that's still a notch against my record. And if I have another one that happens, you know, I still build on those sanctions, whether or not I participated, even if I did everything to prevent it, it's still building. So I think the system is penalizing the licensee, effectively or ineffectively, we could argue. But the question is a lot of the employees, even if I discharge them, are getting a job somewhere else, so why would they stop doing it?
If I can follow up.
Please do.
Do you know if the licensee, when they take that type of corrective action against an employee who's violated the rules and the law, are actually getting something sent back to OLCC regarding their license that they hold as a server? In other words, going back to OLCC, this person is being discharged from our employment mm-hmm. because they sold to someone underage or they gave liquor to someone underage.
Senator Brzezinski, Chair Burdick, we are working with the OLCC right now. That's what my members want, is, you know, a database that's created at the OLCC that says, you know, the server just applied. Do they have any service violations?
Right.
They don't have that today for multiple different reasons, but we are working with the OLCC. That is one of the priorities that both OLCC and us as retailers agree with and are working towards. So, well, I mean, I think it's a very, very effective tool that, once again, as we say today, that person is not being penalized. Even if I discharge them, they've been able to find a job somewhere else most times.
Yep, I appreciate that. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Senator Barr.
Yeah, thank you. So, under current law, I think that doesn't change. The fine is at least $350 and increasing.
No, the fine is...
$350. Depends on which one. Well, the way I see it, because on sub 4, line 23 of the bill, page 1, they're taking out the word at least there and they're inserting below, but I read that so that under current law,
I see, yeah.
the fine is, it's the mandatory minimum, but what I heard Mr. Perry saying is that the courts might not be enforcing that mandatory minimum, and like the testimony from Anita Howard, you know, we have mandatory suspensions of drivers for underage drinking or MIPs, yet out of 12,000 in 2002, only 1,578 actually lost their license. So I think that's what Mr. Perry was testifying to, is that we need to enforce the laws we have, and if there's a reason, you know, why only 10% of the people who, according to state law, MIP is automatic suspension of driver's license, yet only 10% of them are getting that. Why is that? And what's driving that issue? And I guess I'd like to know the answer to that question, too.
Yeah.
If I
may. Prozinski, please.
There's a couple of things. One, the court has to know that it's there. You assume the court would know that. Sometimes courts will take in consideration the impact of that suspension, because I don't think it's a mandatory suspension, that the judge can, in fact, take in consideration whether there's a greater hardship for having them not lose their license. Same thing with less than ounce of marijuana. Even though it's in there, the court can take those things in. I don't know if that's happening or not. I know the courts I'm involved in are very conscious of it, because it's a university community as well as a coastal community. We have a lot of tourism. And I know both sets of the judges that practice in those courts are very aware, and they in those courts are enforcing the minimum on the furnishing on the MIPs. Those are violations, and many of those I don't ever see because they're not I deal with the crimes, not the so, but I'm not sure if they're actually taking into consideration or not.
Other questions? Okay, thank you very much. All right, we will close the hearing. Is there anybody else who wanted to talk on this? Okay, we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 306, and we will adjourn the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Oh,